total death toll surpasses 33,200. Aid workers begin searching for bodies at Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital, following the Israeli carnage at the medical facility. And the top UN court holds the second and final day of hearings on a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany over its support for Israel's war in Gaza. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians are witnessing an endless spiral of death and devastation in Gaza, where U.S. Israeli genocide is now in its seventh month. Israeli aircraft and artillery fire continued in various parts of the Gaza Strip, targeting homes and gatherings of displaced people and killing over 30 people in the past day. The mayor of Al-Maghazi and several others were killed when the regime hit central Gaza. To the south, horrors are continuing even after Israeli occupation forces left the city of Khan Yunis on Sunday. So far, 84 bodies have been recovered from under the rubble. Palestinian medical sources say the regime has also significantly damaged the city's hospital and equipment. Since the start of the U.S.-Israeli onslaught on October 7, over 33,200 people have been killed in Gaza. Aid workers have begun searching for the bodies from the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza after 2 weeks of Israeli attacks on the medical complex. According to relief teams associated with the World Health Organization, the hospital was reduced to ashes by airstrikes and shelling. So far, at least 400 bodies have been discovered. Many patients have died inside the hospital as a result of the Israeli siege on the complex. Israeli forces pulled out of Gaza's largest hospital on Monday. They laid siege to the building and carried out attacks under the pretext that Hamas fighters were operating from there. But the resistance movement has repeatedly denied having any of its fighters inside Al-Shifa or other health facilities. Some aid workers tell about the lack of equipment to plow through the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital, where some recount the horror that they experienced at the medical complex. Let's take a listen.
Once the Israeli army entered within a minute or two, they surrounded the entire area. And after that, they started using the loudspeaker to say, "This is the IDF. The entire area is surrounded and everyone must surrender." Then they started shooting at all the entrances, preventing anyone from moving. I spent 4 days there with my two little daughters, without any food or water. They cried from the hunger. And when they arrested my husband, he had not eaten for 3 days.
The relatives wish to ascertain the fate of their sons, whether they have been killed or missing or have been displaced to the south. The relatives are present to identify their sons and ensure they receive a proper burial. However, we lack the necessary equipment for this task, and time is not on our side. We must complete the job before the bodies decompose.
There are challenges in the Gaza Strip. We don't have forensic doctors or organizations that document the crimes of the Israeli occupation forces. We try to utilize the expertise of the World Health Organization and the UN Humanitarian Office in documenting the crime which occurred inside the Al-Shifa medical complex. The stench of death is everywhere. We try with the help of the delegation of the UN Humanitarian Office and the delegation of the World Health Organization to dig the mass graves in Al-Shifa complex and to identify the decomposed bodies and the body parts that were crushed by the Israeli occupation forces. We try to identify these bodies and document these crimes which were committed against these civilians.
Our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah. He gave us details about the situation in Gaza, including the southern city of Khan Yunis, where Israeli forces withdrew from several days ago.
Given that the destruction there is massive, we can say that roughly 80% of the residential buildings and facilities were completely or partially destroyed. This reflects that there is hundreds of the Palestinian civilians are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those destroyed houses. And this means that the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over that attack will be massive. And as you know, that the civil defense crews, they are searching for those dead bodies, and they are trying to extract those dead bodies having their basic tools, and they are using their bare hands in order to extract those dead bodies. So this actually complicates the process, and this complicates the extraction of those dead bodies. We can say that what happened in Khan Yunis is unprecedented in terms of the massive destruction and mass slaughter of the people there. And even when it comes to Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip, the destruction that was inflicted in those areas by the Israeli occupation forces is nothing compared to what happened and took place in Khan Yunis City. What happened in Khan Yunis City is horrific, because as you know, that everything was breached by the Israeli occupation forces was targeted and destroyed. This included actually the residential buildings, the infrastructure, the pipelines, and everything. Everything was targeted and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the proposal reached during the latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks does not meet the movement's and Palestinians' demands. Hamas says Israel's position in the negotiations held in Egypt remains stubborn. The movement, however, said that it is still studying the proposal and will inform mediators of its response once it is completely reviewed. Hamas did not set any time frame for its response. The movement says that it wants a comprehensive ceasefire that would see the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and the return of Gazans to their homes. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is a main topic as well. The Cairo talks were attended by delegations from Israel, Hamas, Qatar, and the United States. The International Court of Justice is holding a second of proceedings on a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany over arms exports to Israel. Nicaragua argued on the first day of hearings on Monday that Germany is facilitating the Israeli genocide in Gaza by providing weapons to the regime. The Nicaraguan ambassador accused German arms industries of making profits from the devastating situation in Gaza. Carlos José Gómez also pointed out to Germany's defunding of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, saying the move showed Berlin's support for the bloodshed in Gaza. Germany has defended itself in the claim, saying that Israel's security is at the core of Berlin's foreign policy. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed Nicaragua for filing the petition against Germany. It called on other countries to follow the example of Nicaragua and South Africa in taking actions against the genocide in Gaza. Earlier, political commentator Khalid Sayed joined us with his take on Nicaragua's case at the top UN court against Germany over its support for the Israeli war on Gaza.
It's an extremely important move that has been made by Nicaragua, very much in line with what our government has done with regards to taking Israel to the International Criminal Court, or no, to the International Court of Justice, rather. So I think it's, number one, it will result again in the narrative around the involvement of European countries in aiding and abetting genocide being put out there much better in the public domain. Perceptions will be changed, and I think it will most certainly have an impact on the German population. And the German population will then put pressure on their government as a result of it. So most certainly, it will yield results. As you saw with what happened when South Africa went to the International Court of Justice, it shaped more public opinion against the state of Israel. So it's most certainly going to have that effect. And I think we need to commend Nicaragua and actually encourage more and more countries to do the same as Nicaragua has done, following in South Africa's tone.
Iraqi resistance groups say that they have carried out fresh military operations against five vital Israeli targets, retaliation for the regime's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says the targets hit include the Ascalon oil port and the Hadzerim airbase in the city of Beersheba. The umbrella resistance group also vowed to continue targeting enemy strongholds. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli targets. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria, retaliation for Washington's complicity in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Turkey says it has imposed trade restrictions on Israel starting Tuesday, in response to the regime's ongoing onslaught in the Gaza Strip. In a statement, the Turkish Trade Ministry said the export ban has been imposed on a range of products, including construction materials like cement, iron, and steel. It added that the decision will remain in place until Israel declares a ceasefire immediately and allows adequate and uninterrupted flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. This as the Turkish government has been facing public criticism over its double standards as Ankara continues its trade with Israel while at the same time condemns attacks on Gaza. Over the past months, major Turkish cities have witnessed a number of protests against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. The Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement says that Iran has every right to retaliate the recent Israeli attack on its embassy in Syria.
In the end, the Americans have come to the conclusion that there will be a reaction. Even the Israelis, they have come to this conclusion. They have recognized that there will be, I think the whole world has, that this is a natural right for Iran and that it's normal for the Islamic Republic to go ahead with such a retaliation. But of course, everyone's waiting what will happen and the repercussions of what will happen.
Nasrallah made the comments in a ceremony held in commemoration of Iranian Major General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who was killed along with a number of his companions in Damascus. The Hezbollah chief said Israel's stupidity in attacking the Iranian embassy made the U.S. president press Israel to stop the onslaught on Gaza. Nasrallah said Israel has achieved nothing on the ground in Gaza in the past 6 months and has no choice but to stop the genocidal war. Nasrallah also cited Israel's deteriorating situation in the world and its isolation due to its aggression against Palestinians. Well, the depth of the genocide is evident in the piece of breaking news where the Gaza Health Ministry has said that 153 Palestinians have been killed, with 60 others injured in the past 24 hours. 153 killed and 60 others injured. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Syria a week after the Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus. He met with President Bashar al-Assad and Syria's foreign minister to discuss the latest developments. Ibrahim Mahdi reports from Damascus.
In a significant visit as part of his regional tour, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Damascus this Monday. Amir Abdollahian met with President Bashar al-Assad, who considered the Israeli attack against the Iranian embassy and the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza a proof of Israel's failure in achieving any military objectives. Amir Abdollahian highlighted that the Israeli regime is facing its worst times due to the Palestinian resistance, which stands ready to continue its battle against Israel's atrocities.
I have discussed with President Bashar al-Assad a series of events, especially the events in Palestine and the crime that Israel committed against the Iranian consulate in Damascus. This terrorist crime was committed with U.S.-made fighter jets and missiles. Therefore, the U.S. is involved. Israel will receive the due response for its aggression against our consulate in Damascus.
Amir Abdollahian and his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad inspected the Iranian consulate struck by the Israeli regime. They later inaugurated the new Iranian consulate in Syria.
The Israeli aggression against the Iranian consulate in Damascus is a violation of international law and all values on which humanity was founded. The Israeli enemy tries to expand the war due to its complete failure in Gaza. Syria firmly supports the resistance in Gaza and all the resistance movements in the region.
The Iranian foreign minister also stressed that Iran will spare no efforts to stop the genocidal war in Gaza, support its resistance, and deliver humanitarian aid. He concluded his visit at Muassa Hospital to check in on the wounded of the Israeli aggression and express his heartfelt thoughts. This visit comes within the context of Iran's diplomatic efforts to stop the Israeli onslaught in Gaza, and also to reaffirm Iran's right of retaliation for the Israeli heinous crime against the Iranian embassy. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Recent polls in many Western countries show that Israel's atrocities in Gaza have had an unprecedented impact. The French President Emmanuel Macron continues to give unconditional support to Tel Aviv, but the French public opinion has shifted towards Palestine since October 7. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65% to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35% to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work, and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children. And there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
India's main opposition party, the Indian National Congress, has released its election manifesto. The party has promised to boost social spending and to reverse India's democracy. The party says democracy will be at risk if the BJP obtains power in the upcoming general elections, which will begin April 19. And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talked to a man that defied all odds after he was seriously injured during a gun and bomb attack that killed three of his fellow band members in July 1975. Going on to become a beacon of reconciliation, my next guest has embodied the essence of the Irish peace process. So let's introduce today's guest. Joining me today is Steve Travers, a former bass guitarist in the Miami Show Band. Steve survived a horrific attack by the Loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force, that took the lives of his three friends and bandmates. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean. It's nice to be here.
Now, I usually begin by asking the generic question of your childhood growing up, but I would like to get to the crux of our conversation today, which is the story of what had happened on the 31st of July 1975.
Sure. Well, like most young fellas growing up in the 60s, we all wanted to be the Beatles. We wanted to join the Beatles and be pop stars. And as far as living, I was living down in Carrickinshore in South Tipperary, so as far as the North was concerned, it may as well have been the North Pole. To my shame, we say that now. But I started playing, and it was the easiest thing that I ever did. It was easier than having a real job. And so I was headhunted by a number of bands, and one of them was the Miami Show Band. The band was a huge band. It had been going for a long time, but they changed the lineup over the years. You know, people used to come and go. It was an institution, really, that band. Our lead singer, Fran O'Toole, was your archetypical sort of pop star, and the band was also doing its own material, so it was an attractive thing for me to join that band, and hit the ground running really in start of June 1975, and we were, being the summertime, we would have been playing 6-7 nights a week. Anne and I had just, we'd been married the year before. You know, it's all almost like a honeymoon period when you join a band like that, and you get to know new friends and everybody is friendly. And we were, I always like to emphasize the fact that we were a mixed band. We were Catholics and Protestants from North and South, although I had no idea who was, you know, I mean, obviously the accents would give the likes of Ray and Des and Brian away, because clearly they were from the North. But with regard to religion or politics or anything, I had no idea what anybody was, you know. And we were playing, and I remember that particular weekend, last weekend, I suppose, really in July 75, we'd been playing at the Galway Races. And we had been playing there. We played there on the Monday and the Tuesday. When we got home after the two nights, we would normally have the Tuesday off, but because we were playing on the Monday and Tuesday, the night that we were due to have off, we'd like to have one night off a week, but the night we were due to have off was the Thursday night. But we still had one gig to do, and that was in Banbridge, in County Down, just north of Newry. There was plans already set in motion to try to frame the band, the members of the band, as running guns, basically, or bombs, or whatever it was, for the IRA. So we would have been, it was a false flag operation, obviously. And we finished the dance. Ray went home to Antrim in his own car, because we had the following night off, the Thursday night off. So there's five of us got back into the minibus. We had a Volkswagen minibus, for the personnel. We didn't travel with the equipment. The only equipment we carried was our guitar. So Tony Garrity and I, Tony was the lead player, I was the bass player, we carried our equipment. Sometimes we would have brought Desley, as he called himself, his saxophone with him. And we, that was the case that night. So it was Tony's guitar, my guitar, and Des's guitar. And if you know the way they're constructed, those Volkswagen minibuses, there's the engine is in the back, and there's a little shelf at the back, so you can lift a window over the engine. And there was a little shelf, and that's where we used to put those instruments. We wouldn't give our guitars to the roadie, because roadies are inclined to throw stuff into the van, and you know, it's a bit like somebody working in an airline, you know, with your case, you couldn't be sure. So we were precious about them, and we were in good form, because it's a relatively short journey from Banbridge to Dublin. We were based in Dublin, and normally some of the lads, if it's a longish journey, the lads would be nodding off after a while, you know, and I was a bit of an insomniac, so I would always sit up beside Brian McCoy, who was our trumpet player, and Brian was always drove the personnel van as well. He kept it at home, and but because everybody was wide awake and they had no intention of sleeping on the way home, I climbed back into the back to chat with Tony. We were talking about guitars. We're about 6 miles from north of Newry at this time. We weren't long out of Banbridge. Brian turned back to us and said, we've got to stop, there's a roadblock. And you'd come across these, 1975, the troubles were raging. So we knew the drill, at least the lads. I was the least experienced traveling in the north and with stops and roadblocks, but the lads knew the drill, and I got to know them very quickly. You stopped, turned on your interior lights, you turned off your main lights, you let your side lights on, and you approached when you're told to approach. There was a man with a red torch. On this particular time, we were surprised that Brian said, almost apologetically, he was a real gentleman, Brian, and he said, we've got to get out, these gentlemen want to do a check on the van. And for me, being the new recruit from way down south in South Tipperary, you know, I thought this was a big adventure. It was. You know, it was something that, you know, go home and tell him, you know what, we were stopped with by a man with a gun or whatever, you know. But there's a sliding door on the side of the Volkswagen minibus. You just pull it across, and the lads piled out, and I was the last one out. As I got out, I noticed that there was a number of soldiers there. Now, I wouldn't have known one uniform from another. But these were all sort of a darkish type of uniform, and apparently this was UDR uniforms that they were wearing. And some of the men were hunkered down. They were all friendly, to be honest with you. And they told us to line up facing the hedge. And at the hedge, there was a drop of about 3 meters down into the field in front of us. And they told us to put our hands on our heads. And so, you know, intertwine your fingers and put your hands on. Yeah, this was just adding to the adventure for me. And as I say, there was five of us. Ray was gone home. So I was in the middle. And Tony Garrity, our guitar player, was on my left. And Fran was on his left. And then on my right, Brian McCoy was on my right, and Des was on his right. And Des was in, you know, touching distance of the back of the van. That's how close we were to it. And there was banter between the soldiers and ourselves, and they were saying, one of them said, I bet you lads would rather be at home in bed than standing out here at the side of the road. And Fran O'Toole, our singer, was a witty fella, and he said, I bet you lads would rather be at home in bed than sitting in a ditch, because some of them were hunkering down. And I was fascinated by the guns they had, these sort of rifles with perforated barrels. I think they were submachine guns or something like that. And one was laying across this man's legs, and as I say, he was hunkered down. There was another man who seemed to be in charge, and and he was giving the orders, and there was another man there, the man that I think he may have been the person that stopped us and told us to pull in. He had a notebook, and just before we pulled in, there was a car coming up behind us, and when he told us to get out, Brian said, "Can I pull into the side of the road? There's a car coming up fast behind us." And he told us, "Yeah, that's fine." So we're standing there, and everything was very relaxed. And the man in charge told the man with the notebook to get our names and addresses. And so he started at Fran, and he asked Fran his name and address, and Fran was giving it to him. He was about to ask Tony his name, and another man appeared on the scene, and I hadn't seen him. No, I'm not sure if he arrived in the car that was pulling up, coming up behind us, because that particular car never passed us. And but this man, when he arrived, everything changed. The atmosphere changed, and he had a lighter colour fatigues on him, and it was actually fascinating because he had a sidearm, and he had a lighter colour beret, so like a sort of a fawn colour beret, as opposed to the green ones that the other men were had. And he asked the man who appeared to be in charge what the man with the notebook was doing. And the minute he started to talk, I recognised, you know, this is an Englishman. And the men that were hunkered down were standing up now, and everybody was, it appeared as if they were more professional. And this man definitely took charge. And I was just fascinated by this soldier who was made everything that bit sort of more professional. And as I say, Brian McCoy was standing beside me, and he nudged my elbow with his, and he said, "This is British Army." And what he meant was that, you know, this would be done professionally. And I heard a click. They had opened the back of our van, that little shelf, and I heard a click. This was just before the man arrived. I heard this click, and they were opening the guitar cases. And I'll tell you how, you know, I didn't take it seriously. I took my hands down and I turned around and I walked back to the back of the minibus. And I said to him, "Can I help you with that?" I didn't want them touching. I had a very unusual guitar. It was called a Dan Armstrong bass. It was a plexiglass. You could see through it. It was like a glass bass. And there was only about four of them in the country. Phil Innes had one. Brush Shields had one, I had one. There was about four of us had them, and we were precious about them, you know. And so there was two men at the back, and they pointed at a little case. I had a little brown school case type thing, and they said, "What's in that?" I said, "It's effects pedals." It was unusual enough for a bass player to be using effects pedals in 75, but I had a wah-wah pedal and an octave divider, which was called a colour sound octavider. And he said, "Are there any valuables in them?" And I said, "No." I was surprised that he would even ask that. But in hindsight, I think maybe he was asking where the, you know, was the take for the money from the gig or something. I don't know what he meant, but we wouldn't have been carrying that. The roadie would have done all that. And when I said no, he turned me around and punched me in the back and knocked me back into line. But this time, instead of being in the middle, I was next to Des. It was between Des and Brian. So I was second from the van. Brian was reassuring me, and he nudged me and he said, "This is British Army. We'll be away soon." And he actually said British Army, which was important because later on we were able to verify that. And Des chirped in as well, and both of these lads are from the north. Des is from Belfast and Brian's from Caledon, and they would have grown up and know the, you know, different accents as well, and with trained musicians' ears they would know that this is, you know, this is British Army. But and he also said, Des said, the army is usually careful with the equipment, so that was a comforting thing. What we didn't know was that there were two men had taken a 10-pound bomb, commercial explosives, and they were putting it under the driver's seat for years we thought that the, that this thing was placed in the back, which was actually, they were placing it under the driver's seat. And the plan was that we wouldn't know anything about this bomb that they were putting under the thing. And they would have said, thanks very much for your cooperation. We would have driven off, and according to forensics, it would have gone off between 10 and 15 minutes after we left. So nobody would have known about the roadblock, and we would have been, people would have said, well, these fellows were carrying bombs, maybe for the IRA or whatever, and so who can we trust? And they would have put pressure then on the Irish government to have shut down, basically have more stringent security on the border, because at the time, if the IRA had maybe, there was some sort of an outrage and they would have crossed over the border, they were reasonably safe, because not because the Irish government wanted it like that, but because the TDs along the border counties didn't want to disrupt the normal life of people who would have been crossing the border on a daily basis for maybe petrol or groceries, which might have been cheaper at the, you know, on the northern side. And so that was the reluctance. It wasn't for anything else. And but it didn't work. The plan didn't work. They were using a wristwatch timing mechanism. And for one reason or another, maybe they tilted it the wrong way. I don't know anything about these bombs, but this thing exploded, and the two unfortunate men that were planting this bomb, well, if they were blown to pieces, you know, they tore the head off one person, the legs off, and the arms off another. But there was very little left of them. You know, I remember seeing the autopsy reports, and they were. Shocking, the damage. But when it went off, as I say, we were standing right beside it, and there are pictures all over the place of the wreckage. I mean, there was little or nothing left, and it lifted me up into the air, and I remember, you know, being aware that something was happening, and I often say that the whole world turned red. It actually, that's what it looked like to me. And maybe it was the flames or whatever. And I tried to run, but I was in the air, so I couldn't get any purchase on my feet, you know. And I could hear guns going off. It was like as if I was in slow motion. I was just raised up into the air, and then I started to go down through the ditch. As I say, there was about a 3-meter drop into the field. And as I was going down through the ditch, I felt almost like time was coming to a stop, and even through my clothes I could count every single leaf and bramble and every single thing that I was touching. Now, whether that's a heightened awareness from adrenaline or something, I don't know, but I was very aware of all of that. And then all of a sudden time went back to normal, and I hit the ground very hard, and instantly there was two more people fell on top of me, and I think it may well have been Tony and Fran. Now, Des was blown through a separate, there was a trees, and he was blown separately off a bit to the right, so there was the two lads fell on top of me, and somebody then put their hands under my arm. Apparently I was shot while I was in the air. I didn't realize I was shot, but I was shot with what they call a dum-dum bullet, which is specifically designed to explode on impact, and it hit me just over my right hip, and when it entered my body, it exploded into 17 pieces. So it was these things explode when they, and it did a lot of internal damage, and then part of it continued on, and it through my left lung and out under my left arm, so it went right across the body. And somebody put their hands under my arms and started to drag me, maybe to try to get me to stand up, but I was a dead weight at that stage. And and while he was I'm very reluctant to say it was Brian, I'm pretty certain it was Brian McCoy, And the reason I'm reluctant to say it is because I feel guilty that he was murdered dragging me, trying to drag me away from the thing. And he was a Protestant lad from Caledon in County Tyrone, and I'm a Catholic from South Tipperary, and he's dragging me out, trying to drag me away from what's happening. And he was shot in the head and the back, and because the soldiers jumped down after us and started to kill everybody, started to shoot everybody. And so Brian was lying beside me, and I was lying on the ground, and I kept my face to the side. I always remember that my cheek in the grass, just lying down wondering what was happening. And I could hear the others, the soldiers then caught up with Fran and Tony, and they didn't get very far. They tried to run away, but they I could hear the crying and the begging for, and Fran was lying on the ground and he was facing them, and he's asking them not to kill him, and they stood over him and they shot Fran, our singer, 22 times, and 7 of those were in the face. He was a particularly good-looking young lad, and shot Tony in the back of the head, and a number of times as well. And one of the things that stands out for me was the obscenities, the cursing and the swearing, the shouting and roaring of the soldiers, like real anger. That was quite frightening. And when the shooting stopped, then I could hear at least one soldier was walking around, and he was firing into the bodies to make sure they were dead, but they were well dead. And he walked over, and Brian was lying beside me. Brian was dead as well, and he started kicking Brian ferociously. He was like really kicking into him, and shouting and screaming. And then he walked out. I was like about 2 feet away from that, and he turned to me and he stood over me. And will I get up? Will I beg? Will I ask him not to? But I had heard it didn't do the lads a whole lot of good, So I just stayed quiet, and I thought he was going to fire into me. And I was saying to myself, this would be quick. And just as he stood over me and he had a pistol, somebody on the road shouted down, "Come on, those bastards are dead. I got them with dum-dums." I didn't know what a dum-dum was, but I heard him say that very clearly. Des had been blown, as I say, off to the right, into the field, but he was lying closer to the ditch. The ditch was on fire, and there was a danger that he would have been burned alive, but he didn't budge either. But they didn't see him. And so I still thought that when the man said, "Those bastards are dead, I got them with dum-dums," that he would have... I thought he was still going to fire, because he was still standing there. And he turned around miraculously. He started to walk away. And every step that he took, I was saying to myself, I hope he takes another step, because he may not be that accurate. And I was determined not to shout out if he fired. After a while, they seemed to be gone. And then I heard a voice calling. It said, "Fran, Tony, Brian." And then said, "Steve." And I was the only one to answer. I was amazed that the other guys didn't answer, because I was expecting them to answer. But they were dead, obviously. And it was Des, and he said, "Are you okay?" And typical Irish, I said, "I'm grand." I wasn't in pain or anything like that. I didn't feel anything. And so Des got up onto the road, and as he often says, there was carnage on the road. And a truck came down, a lorry, and he asked the truck driver, "I need to get into the police station to report this." But the truck driver didn't know whether he was involved in this, and it wouldn't take him. And then a car came along. They had to sort of stop and manoeuvre, because there was a lot of the bits and pieces of the van that was all over the road. And so eventually Des got into into the police station in Newry, and I was trying to figure out. I rolled over on my back. I was trying to figure out what's just happened here, and I thought that these soldiers had been attacked by the IRA, and that we were caught in the crossfire. That's the only way I could figure it out, because I completely trusted the soldiers I was brought up to, whether it was a policeman, a soldier, a postman, whatever. You wore a uniform, you were a good person, you know, and you had to deserve respect. But I always remember it was absolutely beautiful night, and I was staring up at it was about a half moon there, and it's very warm weather. This was about 2:15, nearly 2:30 in the morning. And I was still trying to figure it out, and I was lying on my back, and I counted my fingers to see if there was any damage done, because as a musician, obviously it's important. I remember tapping my feet together, and we used to wear these ridiculous platform shoes at the time. It was the style, and I could click my feet together, and I knew that I still had my feet. Now I don't know why it dawned on me that I should do this. But there was a terrible smell of, there's no other way to describe it, like meat, cooking meat. Apparently, I didn't know this at the time, but if somebody is shot a number of times with a machine gun or whatever it is, it's the bullets are so hot they actually cook the flesh. And there was the smell of burning blood was terrible. And I got up, I sort of half sat up, and I was able to do that, and I turned around and I kneeled up, and then I stood up, and I noticed that my stomach was extended. I couldn't find any blood, so I said, I heard that man saying dum-dums, that means it was dummy bullets. That's what I said to myself, you know, these weren't real bullets at all. So dum-dums must mean, because I couldn't find any blood.
For the audience's sake, dum-dum bullets are...
explosive bullets. Yeah. Dum-dum bullets are explosive. And so all my bleeding was internal, and my stomach extended out. It felt like it was very big, and I couldn't figure out why that was. And I still had no pain. And when I managed to stand up, I fell down again, and I'd stand up and I'd fall down again. So I decided the best way to get around was to crawl around on my stomach and pull myself around. And sometimes I'd kneel and push myself forward. I knew there was something wrong, because I found it difficult to breathe because the bullet had collapsed my left lung. And so the first one, I was able to reach out to Brian, and I shook him. I said, Brian, are you okay? And there's no answer. And he's been knocked out. You know, he's out for the count. So I crawled over towards Fran, and I won't say the state he was in, but you know, I said to him, Des is gone, and he'll be back soon, so we'll all go home. And I crawled over to Tony, and Tony, like his injuries were bad. He had been, one of the bullets had gone through the back of his head and knocked out his eye onto his cheek, and it was terrible. And I said to him, I remember asking him, did you break a finger? I just would not acknowledge what I was seeing. And that lasts for maybe forever, for a long time, that your mind tells you not, that this is not, you know, you're in denial, basically. And so I crawled as far as the ditch, and I pulled myself up. All I wanted to do was to get some relief, because I couldn't breathe properly. And I pulled myself up onto a little branch, it was hanging towards the field, and I leaned over that to see if I could catch my breath. But and then I'd stand up and I'd fall down again. And remember, that it was almost like a light show. There was the ditch was on fire, and every time, you know, the fire would crackle or whatever, it would light up something. And while I was crawling around, there was body parts on the one of these unfortunate men. And his arm was in the field, and it was it's surreal. It's like a bad nightmare. And you're telling yourself, you know, you're just ignoring that. And eventually, then I heard walkie-talkies. This was after about an hour. I spent about an hour crawling around the field and telling the lads that, you know, I said, Tony's fine. And I said to Fran, you know, Brian is seems to be out for the count, but Des will be back soon with help. And I heard these walkie-talkies, and I was convinced that the men had come back to finish off this thing. I heard somebody jump down into the field, and I said to myself, you know, I'm going to stand up. I'm not going to die lying down. So I stood up and I faced what I could hear coming towards me, and it shone a light on my face. And I remember a man saying, oh, we're the police, son. And I went to walk towards him, and the ground was sort of it was uneven, and I actually tripped, and he caught me. There was two policemen. They caught me. They eventually got me into the hospital, and I remember they were running down this corridor with me, and all the lights flying past me, and they put me up on an operating table, and they were questioning me. There was men there questioning me, and I don't know whether they were doctors or police or whatever it was, but they were. One of them said, "You know, what happened to you?" And I said, "I fell through a ditch." That's the only explanation I gave him. I fell through a ditch. And he said, well, you've got some scratches and marks. He said, what are they? I said, well, the ditch. And there was this nurse came over, and she had a scissors. And I had a blue jumper on me and a sort of a black jeans. And she said, I'm going to cut this now. I said, no, you're not. She said, I've got to cut this off. She had a scissors. I said, I just bought it last week. So I put my hands back, and they gave in, and they actually took it off me without cutting it. So I was happy enough with that. And these people were pointing at I had a small wound on the right and a small wound on the left. And these were the entry and exit wounds. I just kept saying, you know, I fell through a ditch. And I remember the one man said, what were you doing up here? They obviously heard my accent, which isn't Northern accent. Said, what were you doing up here? And I said, I was playing. No idea that they didn't know who we were, you know, because if we go into a shop, everybody knows who you are, you know. I said, well, I was playing. And he said, I don't remember. He said, playing at what? So eventually, I said, playing music. And I think they started to realize this is a band. Next thing, all of these machines started to come down. I think it was x-rays or something like that, and all the banging and the noise from these. And next thing, I woke up hours later, 8 or 9 hours later, and it's just my wife was just standing there. She had been, they had, Billy and Marie brought her up, and when they arrived at Daisy Hill Hospital, there was a lot of security, and there was a lot of commotion outside Daisy Hill, and Billy went straight over to the security man with a clipboard, and Billy said, we're here to see Stephen Travers. And and Anne was there. She was only 21, you know, 22, he said, Travers, he looked down the clip and he said, oh yeah, he's dead. And Billy said, no, check it again. He said, we're told he's okay. And he said, oh, my mistake, he's in theatre. And so 8 or 9 hours. But I have to say, Daisy Hill Hospital, within 24 hours, 48 hours of the whole thing happening, gave me back my faith in mankind. They're just amazing people, you know, amazing people.
Steve, it's an extraordinary story. Well, we'll all be looking forward to reading that. Steve,
thanks.
Once again, I want to thank you for coming to Belfast. Always good to have you here.
It's always great to be in Belfast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
And that does it for another week. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Dozens of civilians are killed in the latest Israeli attacks in Gaza, with a total